This week on Lunchbox Envy, genetically, they are more closely related to humans than to plants.
350 million years ago, they grew 6 meters tall.
And in 2014, hallucinogenic ones were found growing in the gardens of Buckingham Palace.
It's mushrooms! Welcome to Lunchbox Envy. I'm Rosie, I'm a chef and food writer, and I'm here with my QI elves, Jack and Manu. Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
We are exploring both mushrooms and truffles.
And beyond. I've got things on this as a fungi.
Well, yeah. Shall we first talk about what is a mushroom?
It is like a vegetable, a meaningless culinary term. There is no such thing as a mushroom, scientifically speaking.
Just to say, it means something to me.
Yeah.
All right.
It's useful culinarily. Yeah. You wouldn't be like, oh, can I have some of that bellosporum? Like, you know.
Well, speak to yourself.
I was going to say, Jack.
Whatever that word, I don't even know if that's a real word, but like, you know. Like.
Today, we're basically covering all of the edible species of fungus.
Mm.
Now, the fungi are a separate kingdom. They're neither plants nor animals, and they're very varied. There's millions of species. So we're just looking at this sort of subsection of edible ones. Mushrooms are what we expect as a kind of like a stalk with a cap.
Mm.
And then we'll go into maybe some truffles, which are basically underground mushrooms, but they're the fruiting body because large parts of the fungus are just like what's the equivalent of a root, a root system, which is known as the mycorrhizal network. And then they'll stick out fruiting bodies in order to spread spores, much like a fruit in a plant would.
In a kitchen, do you distinguish between truffles as separate from mushrooms?
Yeah, they are stored and treated differently.
And what about morels?
Morels are a bit in the middle. They aren't the same as normal mushrooms.
Huitlacoche?
Don't come across that so much over here.
What is that?
Well, I'll come into it later. It's a specific type of fungus.
It's a cool mushroom.
There are 1.5 million species of mushroom that we've identified.
Wow.
So, and we still think we've only found 1% of them. So it's an enormously broad and varied kingdom of organisms.
And sorry, when you say mushroom, you mean fungi.
Well, yeah, I do mean fungi. But okay. I think, do you expect a mushroom to have a stalk and then a little cap?
I think of mushrooms as things that eat dying or dead other things.
Right.
Like it's... Yeah.
Like a lion.
Well, not a predator so much. What's it called?
A scavenger.
A detritivore.
Detritivore.
Ooh.
That's because I know that they grow in the sort of forest mush, as it were.
Because we also have toadstools as well. It's another category of, not a real category, but it is something that we use to describe more fungi. So the classical definition is mushrooms are edible.
Okay.
Toadstools are poisonous.
Well, have you heard the epithet, like, all mushrooms are edible, some are only edible once?
This is very, this is very true.
Well, I'm too scared to forage mushrooms for that very reason.
I think Brits in general are. I think there's definitely a culture in other countries of foraging. When I was living in France, there was just a week in like October, November, when suddenly the forest was full of locals all foraging the mushrooms.
Oh, they get really protective of their patches.
Yeah, they do.
One of my friends has a patch that's been passed down through her family.
Sure.
And like it's top secret.
Well, they own it. Like,
oh no, it's just like someone in their family years ago found a really good patch. And it's their family secret.
For which mushrooms, may I ask?
I think chanterelles.
You would be protective of that.
Mm-hmm.
Lovely mushroom, a chanterelle.
Mm. Yeah, they're already tasty.
I think part of the reason they're much more keen to go foraging is if you go to your local pharmacy, of which there are thousands in France, you see those pharmacy signs everywhere, the local pharmacist has to have some sort of basic level of mushroom knowledge to be able to tell you if your mushroom's poisonous. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
That's very useful.
I know.
That sounds so sensible to me.
Part of qualifying as a pharmacist.
I was reading a paper written in 2021 where they did like a global review of all of the different kinds of edible mushroom. And they found that there were like 2,000 completely edible safe ones. Mm-hmm. And then 183 on top of those that needed a little bit of extra prep. But there were 471 left that no one has any idea about because people are too scared to try them. So I'm like, who's going to go for those?
So there really is nothing they can test them on, right? Like, not even animals?
Well, not really, no, because some animals can eat mushrooms that are safer. Like squirrels can eat a mushroom called panther caps. They're totally fine. It would cause seizures and hallucinations and even retrograde amnesia in us, which is basically you wouldn't remember anything before you ate the mushroom.
Whoa.
But they're fine.
That's like the tool they use in Men in Black.
Oh, yeah. Just get one of these.
But mushrooms just, I mean, botanically, they're so fascinating because, maybe I shouldn't say botanically.
They are separate.
Mycologically, because mycology is a study of fungi. They are fascinating. Like I said, we know about 1% of the species. Mm. And I remember learning in A-level biology that animals are made of glycogen, plants are made of cellulose, and mushrooms are also made of glycogen, which is why they're often used as a meat replacement because they're basically flesh.
Yeah.
I mean, saying they're basically flesh is a bit of a crowbar, but it's the same chemical, and they also can't photosynthesize like us. So they respire in the same way, like on a micro biochemical level, they're making energy in the same way that we do. Mm. We see them as plants because they grow in soil and they're fixed to the ground.
But yeah, that's exactly why, say, them being more similar to us, they can absorb vitamin D from the sun like we can. So
that's
if you flip them upside down and you put them by the window, quite a lot of mushrooms will store that vitamin D and then you can eat it. Which is really good.
Oh, that's really clever.
So you don't need to spend all your money on vitamin D supplements. You can just buy a shit ton of mushrooms.
Yeah.
And speaking of mushrooms and darkness, you can grow mushrooms in the dark, but you don't have to. It's a bit like the rice paddies. Like they're fine with water, but they don't need it. So mushrooms, because they don't photosynthesize, you don't need to give them light, which means you can grow them in spaces where you can't grow plants, such as caves and cellars, and they'll grow just as well. And then also they can grow during the night as easily as in the day, which is why in the 1800s, Parisians, in times of hardship, would grow mushrooms in the catacombs under Paris.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which is why they're known as champignons de Paris.
That's so wild.
The scales have been lifted from your eyes.
No, love, they grow so fast. I don't know if you've ever seen a time lapse of a mushroom growing.
You know that speeded up.
I remember visiting one of my friend's house. She's a chef and she grows her own shrooms. And I got there one day and they were starting to pop out of the like bag. You get them in a kind of grow bag thing. And that's called popcorning when the tops are like boop, boop, boop. And then 2 days later, I came back to the room and they were like nearly fully grown oyster mushrooms. They're so quick.
So Beatrix Potter, the author and illustrator of such children's books as Peter Rabbit and Jemima Puddle Duck, Jeremy Fisher, I think the late 19th century, maybe early 20th. She started out as a mycologist. She had a published paper on the germination of the spores of the agaricnii. And I think she wrote a book, actually.
She's definitely high all the time.
She
was just realised.
And she would draw such detailed and beautiful pictures of these fungus species that then she turned her hand to children's writing and she illustrated all of her books. So the Peter Rabbit that you see every day is an original Beatrix Potter.
All of her delusions that she had whilst on psilocybin. Okay, our first lunchbox today is my lunchbox. I've made a recipe of mine that I love, and it's just a mushroom linguine. You know I can't stay away from a pasta dish. I think mushrooms and pasta go great together. So here you go, guys.
Thank you.
The reason why I wanted to make this is because I tested a theory whilst I made it.
Okay.
Not a theory, it's a fact. It's very much proven. But it's something that for me has taken me a long time to get into my head as a good cooking method for mushrooms. Well, so
it's fantastic.
It's so good.
Oh, good. It'd be rubbish if it wasn't. Have always treated mushrooms the same way, which is that I cook them like I would cook meat. So I was very interested to hear what you said, Jack, about them being made of glycogen, the same as humans, because they do perform way more like meat in culinary terms than they do a vegetable.
Cook your mushrooms like you would cook a human.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
It's whatever. Yeah,
lots of butter.
Yeah.
Glycogen is common to all animals, so chicken as well is made of glycogen, and so is beef and lamb and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. So mushrooms, they're also quite high in protein, 3 grams to every 100 grams.
Oh, okay.
And that means that they brown really easily. They're really good browners. I think we all know that the best mushroom flavor is when it's nicely browned in a pan. So my sort of best practice that I had for myself was that I would always cook them in batches because they release a lot of water when they go into the pan, giving them lots of space, high heat, plenty of fat. It's kind of similar to how you would treat a lot of meat, beef in particular. It's almost like a steak, right? What you might have noticed when you cook mushrooms, particularly in oil, but in all fats, is that they absorb all of the fat or a lot of the fat in the pan. Mm. You keep having to add oil. You keep being like, what's going on here? Like,
they're absolute sponges.
They've soaked up all the oil. There is actually a reason for this, and there is a way to get around it. Basically, stems and caps of mushrooms are made up of a network of fibers called hyphae, and they are 80 to 90% water. That tissue contains loads and loads and loads of air pockets, which, when they're raw, oil can collect in those air pockets, right?
Okay.
I watched a video from America's Test Kitchen. He put 100 grams of raw mushrooms in a bowl of vegetable oil. Mm. He also put 100 grams of cooked mushrooms, he just bunged them in the microwave, in another bowl of vegetable oil, same amount. The raw mushrooms absorbed 42 grams of the oil.
Whoa.
Wow.
And the cooked mushrooms absorbed 2 grams.
Ooh. Oh, wow.
So
cook your mushrooms before you cook them.
Yeah, I was going to say, how do you cook?
You might have heard this. This has been sort of like coming up in the chat of the culinary world. It's basically that you should be...
Oh, are you in that WhatsApp group?
You should be dry frying your mushrooms.
Oh.
You shouldn't be cooking them in oil at all to begin with.
Goodness.
Whoa.
Get out all of that water, get out all of that air
that's
in those pockets. And that means that when you then add your fat, they won't absorb it, basically.
So when we say dry frying, just straight in the pan, high heat, nothing.
Nothing. Salt is fine. Okay. Salt you can add.
Like you would toast spices.
Kind of how you would toast spices. And it's kind of also how you would cook a really fatty piece of meat, because you'd rely on the fat from the meat to stop them from sticking and stuff. Now, I've typically avoided doing this because I don't like the sound.
Oh, really?
The squeaky sound of the mushrooms literally makes my skin crawl. Like, I hate the sound of it.
It's like a blackboard and some nails.
Yeah, feels very antithetical to how I was taught to cook mushrooms. Yeah. And also, I quite like the greasy mushroom, can I be honest?
True.
Like, I haven't got a problem with it. I don't mind if it's a little bit greasy.
Is it because the water escapes when it gets hot and then the fat fills its place?
I think that the cell walls shrink, basically.
Okay,
so there's nowhere for it to go.
Yeah.
And something else that's really interesting about mushrooms is the makeup of those cell walls. It's made up of something called chitin.
Oh, yes.
Have you heard of chitin?
Oh, yeah. Mm-mm.
Chitin is the same thing that's in the exoskeletons of shellfish and prawns and, you know, crabs, for example. Actually, there's a misconception that humans can't digest chitin. Mm. It's not true.
Oh, really?
Like, have you ever eaten a raw mushroom? You'll be fine. Yeah. But there was a theory for a long time that people were like, you can't eat raw mushrooms. You have to cook them because they've got chitin in. But chitin is really heat stable. You've seen shellfish shells. Like, they don't really degrade at all during cooking. Mm-mm. You'd have to really cook the shit out of them to have a problem with it. It's kind of the same thing with mushrooms. I don't know if you've ever noticed, but it's really hard to overcook a mushroom.
Yeah, that's true.
The only really way you can do it is by cutting them so thin that they dry out so much and become crispy and wrinkled and gross, or literally burn them.
Yeah.
It's quite hard to overcook them.
That's a good point. I never thought about that.
Yeah, in fact, in the same America's Test Kitchen video, he did an experiment where he steamed a piece of courgette, a piece of fillet steak and a piece of mushroom in the same steamer for 45 minutes.
Okay.
At the end, the beef, extremely overcooked, extremely tough, rubbery, not pleasant at all. The courgette, it's the opposite. Mush. It's so mushy and soft. The mushroom, 10 out of 10. You wouldn't have noticed if it had been there for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, 45 minutes. Goodness. And obviously, like, you know, there is a limit. But they are actually pretty robust because of all of this chitin in their cell walls.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And that's taking me back to my meat theory. I tried today where I basically dry fried the mushrooms and I put like my fingers in my ears and just got on with it. And it has come out really great. Yeah. Like they're lovely caramelization. You can taste the butter. You can sort of like sense that there's fat in this, but it's not oozing out of the mushroom every time I bite into it. Mm. And yeah, I think the dry sear, unfortunately, as much as I dislike it, is the way to go.
But it does depend on priorities. Like there's often this best practice, but that's in order to have your mushrooms taste, I don't know, like a restaurant or something. But you're right, there's a joy to a greasy, soggy mushroom.
Yeah.
And if that's how you want to do it and it saves time and effort, then
yeah, go for
it.
You know, in like greasy spoon calves, they just deep fry the mushrooms.
Do they?
That's why they have such even colour on the sausages and the mushrooms. They just like bung them in the deep fryer.
Weird and wrinkly as well.
Yeah, like, not always.
It's not the best mushroom.
It's not always my favourite.
No.
Anyway, so there's another myth I wanted to bust. Well, I guess I wasn't busting myths necessarily before, but I'm going to do one now. The myth is you can't wash mushrooms.
The reason you can't wash mushrooms is supposedly they absorb all the water and they get very mushy.
Yeah, you can wash mushrooms. Obviously, you can't wash them like you wash up a plate. Like, that's ridiculous. Mm. But you can put water on mushrooms. They are porous. They will absorb water. And they also contain loads of water. We know that. They will absorb some water. But it shouldn't really create more than a minute's more worth of cooking than you actually think. The thing you should avoid doing is washing them and then storing them when they haven't been cooked, when they're wet, because that will encourage spoilage. What you should be doing is washing your mushrooms just before you cook with them. And listen, it's not necessary to wash all mushrooms. Certainly the ones in the supermarket are pretty good. I just tend to give them a wipe with a bit of kitchen towel. Mm-hmm. The mushrooms that you might have to wash are wild mushrooms that have been foraged.
Of course, yeah.
In the restaurant that I used to work in, we had a thing where we basically set up three massive bowls of water and we dunk the mushrooms in one bowl and then into another bowl. So they were going repeatedly into cleaner water each time, and then we dry them out for a bit and then cook with them, and that worked really well. Like
you wouldn't want to be the last mushroom to get dunked. Doesn't sound fun.
No,
but you can get the like the foraging knives are super cool because they've got a little curve. Yeah, and then on the other end some of them have a brush.
Yeah, brushing them. Oh, it's so satisfying.
Manny basically carries a knife with her at all times.
It's just like a little Swiss Army knife.
I love those knives. Yeah.
They're so good.
Does it have a brush function?
Not yet.
And then the other thing just to note is that if you're storing mushrooms, try and avoid plastic. Because plastic doesn't allow any moisture to escape.
Yes, it retains moisture. Yeah.
You're best off in a brown paper bag with some kitchen towel.
Yeah, your mushrooms will sweat.
Or even like on a tray with some kitchen towel.
This is, I guess, why when you're foraging, you have the cute little basket. Like it's not just plastic. Oh, and another thing about the basket, which I love so much, is it's so that the mushrooms can drop spores along the way.
That's
so you're
clever.
Foraging them
that
and then you're
clever.
Like re-sporing the earth as you're going along.
Spores are the mushroom equivalent of seeds, aren't they?
Yeah. And the only other thing I wanted to talk about was probably my favorite thing about mushrooms of all, which is that they communicate with each other.
What? Ooh. Is it the scream as you're cooking them?
That's what the squeaky thing is. It's like,
No. So mathematical analysis of the electrical signals that fungi seemingly send to one another has identified patterns that bear a pretty striking resemblance to human speech.
Wow.
It's not conclusive that it is similar to speech, but it is really, really, really like similar.
Sure. I've often held the theory that like plants communicate through smells, right? So when you're chopping parsley, is that not the scream of parsley?
God, that's so morbid.
I think it's like with grass as well. When you mow your lawn, it's releasing smells that's like, oh my God, guys, grow, we're dying.
Attack, yeah. So Professor Andrew Adamatsky at UWE, west of England, Bristol, he analysed patterns of electrical spikes generated by four series of fungi.
This is the most Bristol research you could have. If you haven't been to Bristol, there's
they love mushrooms over in Bristol.
Baby mushroom shots, so good.
So anyway, he analysed the patterns of electrical spikes generated by four species of fungi. Enoki, which you will have eaten before, split gill, ghost and caterpillar fungi. And basically the research found that these spikes often clustered into trains of activity resembling vocabularies of up to 50 words.
Wow.
And the distribution of these fungal word lengths closely matched like human languages, basically.
Wow.
It's just kind of like insane to think that they are potentially conversing.
Yeah.
We already knew that there was some kind of form of like telepathy almost in these organisms.
Sure, yeah.
But now it seems like they're actually genuinely having a chat.
Wonder what they're talking about.
Well,
amazing to imagine, like, yeah, parallel world under the soil where they've like invented podcasts and there's like Mushroom Manu, Mushroom Rosie and Mushroom Jack. We're all sitting around talking about how weird humans are.
And I actually first heard about this not from this very informative study, but because my mum had read a book, Entangled Life.
Entangled Life by Merlin Sheldrake.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful book.
Apparently it's great.
Yeah. It's really eye-opening. He's like sort of dives into the science behind mushrooms and how much and how little we know about them. And he describes like mycelial networks trading nutrients with plants and suffocating nematode worms that they've attracted with their roots, and like the power of psilocybin as a treatment for all sorts of things.
And
but he weaves it in with quite a poetic sense of like, certainly the truffles chapter was fascinating, sort of.
Well, my mum,
quite sexy actually.
My mum said it was like one of the most inspiring things she's ever read,
really,
and that she was really like moved by it. And now whenever we go on walks, she hugs trees.
Oh, I love that.
Love that. Okay, it's time for our second lunchbox, and that is from you, Jack.
Okay, this week I've brought a truffle for us to try.
Oh,
luxurious.
This is known as a summer truffle. The budget wouldn't stretch to a black Perigord truffle.
A fresh truffle, basically.
Yeah. Nor would it stretch to an even more expensive white Alba truffle. Those go for thousands of pounds if they're at all sizable.
What is everyone's, how do we feel about truffles?
I will ask you about what you know about truffles, what you think about truffles.
It doesn't make a dish like immediately better. I feel there's a few places that just use them to make stuff more expensive.
Okay.
They're kind of the caviar of the fungal world, right? They are
an
expensive, acquired taste.
Mm. Yeah.
And they are used in a way that is not necessarily as cool as you think it is. That's my feeling about them.
I like gold leaf is another one.
Yeah.
So the 101 on truffles, they are the fruiting body of a number of species, but uniquely, truffles are hypogeous, so they grow underground, whereas most of the mushrooms we eat, like seps and chanterelles and button, they're epigeous, so they grow above ground. So what's interesting about that is that they still, because of the fruiting body, they still have to spread spores, which are basically mushroom seeds. And so given that they can't be above ground, they can't get their spores away on the wind, they can't rely on animals to see them and come and eat them and then deposit spores in the feces. So they've developed an incredible smell. And it's competing with the cacophony of a forest, which is full of smells. And they basically just have to be as pungent as possible and hopefully as attractive as possible. And the means of evolution mean that the less attractive smelling ones don't spread their spores, which has meant that they are still an acquired taste. And actually, a lot of truffles smell pretty revolting. Pretty much all of the 1,000 or so North American truffles are not dyes. Like, they smell of baby diarrhea or sewage pipes. And in fact, they did some research and found that one of the main smelly compounds is androstenol, which is found in the sex hormone of pigs.
Oh.
Well, I remember going on holidays to Umbria in central Italy. Umbria and Tuscany are probably two of the most truffle-heavy parts of Italy that you can go to. And there would be shops with like wild boar heads all over them. They sell a lot of wild boar and a lot of fresh and dried and, you know, cured truffle. And it stunk. It absolutely stunk. And I was like, you know, a kid, and I was like, what is wrong with everyone? Like, why do you like the smell of these shops? Like, the truffle stink, the boar heads stink. Like, where am I?
Yeah.
Now I'm a bit more grown up, I understand.
But truffles grow in symbiosis with trees. So their mycorrhizome is always transferring nutrients with the trees, which is why you find them in forests. Yeah. And also why we can't successfully farm them. Mm. Like, it has happened on occasion, but it's a bit of guesswork is involved, because there's so many different factors that we don't yet understand, which is partly why they're expensive, because you have to forage for them and they're not visible above ground, which means you often employ animals to be trained to hunt them down. Mm-hmm. And typically it would be pigs. And we think maybe it's something to do with the fact that they're producing pig sex hormone. Mm. But the trouble with pigs is they love them. So they'll just eat them when they find them. So you typically would, in the Victorian times, you would give them a muzzle so they couldn't eat them. Yeah. But you can also use dogs who don't often like to eat them. And they're much easier to train.
It's a specific breed as well.
But trufficulture used to be big. In France, in the last 150 years, the yields of France's trufficulturalists has gone down 99%.
Whoa.
Wow.
Like, we're making 1% of what we used to. And that's partly because the local sort of folk knowledge on where best to grow truffles and find truffles has died, because people have moved to the cities and there have been numerous wars, and basically just that knowledge is lost, which has kind of led to the increase in the price. But, you know, they used to be a pretty common delicacy.
Yeah, because, like, there's lots of French dishes where they, like, stuff a whole chicken skin with, like, truffle slices all the way up and down it, and it looks amazing, and it tastes probably, you know, if you like truffles, amazing. But that was that would have cost a pretty penny.
Yeah. I was gonna say, why do we call them chocolate truffles?
That's purely just a visual thing. So they're, like, small, quite round, but also quite knobbly and brown. Similar size.
But it's interesting, because they must have been ubiquitous enough for people to think that's a good name for this.
Exactly, yeah.
We know what truffles are. Mm. But now I would bet you that lots of people wouldn't know what a truffle looked like.
No.
Because also the products that we've come across on mainstream shelves are actually never close to the real thing. They're truffle oils, they're truffle pastes, they're truffle butters.
Yes, because the flavor of truffle doesn't dissolve in oil. So if you find truffle oil, it's been basically infused with the compound 2,4-dithiapentane, which is basically, you can isolate it in a laboratory.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's the same stuff, but it's obviously not come from a truffle.
No.
So you make your own call as to whether that's authentic or not. But it usually contains, like, a microscopic amount of truffle, so they can put truffle on the label of ingredients.
We were always taught in the kitchen, if you had fresh truffles, that you stored them in something porous. So risotto rice was usually the thing that we would store them in, because the rice would soak up any residual moisture, stop them from spoiling. Yeah. The other thing we would do is we would put truffles in boxes of eggs, because eggshells are porous. Yeah. So they would soak up some of the truffle fragrance, and then you could make really amazing truffled scrambled eggs without actually having to use as much truffle, because they'd soaked up all the flavor.
So cool. That's cool.
Yeah. It's quite a clever thing. Listen, like, I'm never going to, like, seek out truffle. I love, like, white truffle and good black truffle are amazing every now and again, if they're fresh in front of you, but I'm never going to pay for it. I'm such a cheapskate. Yeah. I'm not going to be like, yeah, I'll have that extra 24 quid on that butter pasta. Thank you.
Yeah. But I would like to experience that one day, because people do talk about the incredible heady aroma, which I must say these cheap ones don't really have.
Yeah. Okay. I think a good truffle for me is almost garlicky. Mm. Like, it's so rounded and umami, the flavor. But there are lots of restaurants in Italy, and there's a couple that do this in London, for example, where you can bring your own truffle.
Really?
So you just ring up the restaurant and you say, I've got a truffle, I'd love to come in and have a risotto. Would you cook me a risotto with my truffle?
Amazing.
Bocca di Lupo in central London will do this for you.
Wow.
You pay like a truffleage, almost like corkage, when you bring in your own wine. You pay a little surcharge for them to cook with your truffle.
So
you might generously give the rest of it to the restaurant so that they can use it. And, you know, it depends how good a customer you are.
So I've sliced this one into three. Should we give it a try?
Let's do it.
the tiniest bit just like almost takes your head off, doesn't it? It's just like so strong.
Fragrant AF. Their name in Castilian Spanish is Turmas de Tierra. Earth testicles.
Oh, wow.
They do look a bit like that.
I was going to say, there's something wrong with you, though, if your testicles look like that. Oh, these ones are tiny and black.
I'm going to see a doctor. There's also a theory that they're the original manna from heaven.
Oh, yeah.
Because when the Jews were going through the desert in the Bible, they'd been expelled from Egypt. They were hungry and thirsty, and there was a thunderstorm. And supposedly, this nitrogen in the air brings out the desert truffles, because there are such things as desert truffles. And so they would have seen these sort of truffles lying around and realized that they're edible and delicious and not knowing where they're from and assumed they'd come from heaven.
Whoa. Wow.
It's just a theory.
Just before we leave gross mushroom flavors, sorry to dick on your truffle.
Dick on my truffle whenever you like, Manny.
Have you heard of the flaccid penis mushroom?
No, what does that look
so
like?
So good. So it's a mushroom called the Phallus druesi, which was discovered in 2009 off the west coast of Africa. And it was named after the curator of herpetology at the California Academy of Sciences, who's called Robert Drews. And he was the one that encouraged these scientists to go out and look for new species. And it is like so phallic and quite droopy. And apparently it smells like rotting fish.
Oh, God.
And people...
Would you not be really upset if that was you? Yeah. Sorry, but like poor old Robert Drews. That's the worst mushroom I can think of.
You know
to be named after.
So people asked him about this. They're like, how do you feel? Are you okay? And he is like, yeah, I'm not that fussed. It's really nice having something named after me. He's also got two other things named after him, which include a moss frog and a blind worm snake.
Okay. Like fishy, flaccid penis mushroom isn't probably up there in top 10 things you'd want referring back to you.
True, but we are talking about him, though.
Yeah, that's true.
There we go.
Druzy, you're in. Friend of the pod from now.
Speaking of phallic mushrooms, have you heard of the stinkhorn?
Oh, no.
Also looked very phallic. Charles Darwin's niece, Gwen Raverat, which is a great name, she recorded how her aunt Etty would set off in her hunting cloak and go around woods and sniff out these stinkhorns and rush them home and secretly burn them in the drawing room so that she wouldn't ruin the morals of the maidens walking around the forest.
Well, they surely like they wouldn't have known what a penis looked like anyway.
Well, exactly.
Wouldn't have been a problem.
That's a good point.
If they were behaving themselves, it doesn't matter.
Another interesting mushroom, the jack-o'-lantern mushroom, which glows in the dark.
Oh, sick.
It gives off a greenish light known as foxfire.
Ooh.
The fungal filaments also spread into diseased woods. It's called touchwood.
Is it like glowing trees?
Yeah, glowing trees.
That's so cool.
It glows brightly for 1 or 2 weeks.
Nice.
In fact, World War I soldiers would tuck some into their helmets to stop them bumping into each other at night.
That's cute. Yeah. I think that's the only story from World War I.
Yeah, that's actually quite cute. Yeah, that's true. I have some funny words for North American mushrooms. I mentioned stinkhorns, witch's butter, turkey tails, yuck on a stick.
Nice.
Yellow wart and shaggy mane.
These sound genuinely like adult film titles.
Yuck on a stick.
Yeah, it's like a pub quiz round, font or cheese or porn film or mushroom.
Oh, it's so good.
Have you ever tried hen of the woods mushroom?
Chicken of the woods. I've always wanted to.
I had a burger in the Spread Eagle.
I was going to say.
London's oldest vegan pub.
Hen of the woods or chicken of the woods mushroom is a mushroom that's kind of like, firstly, it does look a bit like a chicken's ass, like it's sort of plumed weirdly, but it is actually super similar to chicken when it's cooked.
Yeah,
it
really
tastes
umami.
Meaty and has a very similar texture, like the strands of the proteins in the meat and the mushroom, you like they're really quite close to each other, which is why it is called hen of the woods.
Okay.
A great little vegan substitute for chicken.
They're quite spending, aren't they?
They are, because they're foraged and seasonal.
Can't farm them.
The other one I have never tried, I'm too scared to try, is puffball.
Oh.
Because I've heard puffball can make you ill. And puffballs are another easily foraged mushrooms, and again, all over the West Country.
Mm-hmm. They are fascinating. I did some deep dives into puffballs. Mm-hmm. So firstly, they can be 40 inches in diameter. So what's that, 100 centimetres?
Wow.
A full metre. And 25 kilos.
That's kind of like the size of this table.
Yeah. Fields of puffballs get mistaken for grazing sheep sometimes.
Really?
Yeah.
That's so cute.
I think if you're, you know, driving past. But they produce 7 trillion spores over their lifetime.
Whoa.
But they're lucky if even one of them grows to maturity. So it's a really bad hit rate. In fact, if they all managed to, I did some maths, in 2 generations, they would create puffballs 800 times the volume of the Earth.
Whoa.
Oh, well, that's lucky that they don't then. I'm a bit scared now.
Yeah.
Puffball invasion.
7 trillion to 1, they're your chance of growing to maturity as a puffball.
It would be a bouncy world, though. Mm. I like it.
And a direct hit from a raindrop sends 1 million spores into the air at 1 meter per second. The giant ones actually belong to the Calvatia group, which roughly translates as baldy. Because they do look like basically bald men's heads.
They look like Uncle Fester's head from Adam's Family.
Yeah, that's exactly it. But then there was a reordering of fungal taxonomy quite recently, and they moved from that group to the genus Lycoperdon, which means wolf fart.
It sounds like Lycoverdon.
Lycoperdon.
Puffed for the very first time. Let's dive into our third and final lunchbox, and that's yours, Manu. What have you got? It looks like a pot of forest floor.
It is a pot of forest floor.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Are we going to have to eat it?
No. Okay, thankfully, good. No. So today I have bought something that is meant to represent human compost.
Oh, but it's not actually.
No, it's definitely not. This is supposed to represent human remains that have been purified by mushrooms.
Okay.
So, like we've already discussed, mushrooms are detritivores, so they break down organic matter. And one of the things some of them do is to purify it, so to detoxify what they're breaking down.
Right.
And when we die, like, humans are full of shit. Like, we're really bad for the planet. When we degrade, we can carry up to like 200 dangerous chemicals that we accumulate over the years. So stuff like plastics, like phthalates.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's not even including the microplastics beaded body wash.
Phthalates are hormone disruptors. So they're bad for us when we're alive. They're bad for the grounds when we die. There's also something called BPA, bisphenol A, that lines tin cans and gives the food in it a slightly longer shelf life. But that's also a hormone disruptor, bad for the planet. Then you've got stuff like mercury in fillings.
Mm-hmm. Not anymore, but historically. But,
back in the day. So if you're cremated, it releases mercury into the atmosphere. So a few years ago, about 2,250 kilograms of mercury was being released into the atmosphere every year through cremation. And it's even worse if you've been embalmed. So I don't know if you guys know a lot about embalming.
I don't know a lot about it, but I know that it's really bad for the environment.
It's super bad. So classically, they pump your body full of formaldehyde, which is a carcinogen, and it can give funeral workers cancer and lung issues. Yikes. It's like super messed up chemicals. All of this stuff happens to their bodies because we're, for some reason, really scared of decaying and dying. Mm. And it's a whole...
There being no trace of us. I think we want a legacy, don't we?
So it's something that's been called death denial, like kind of having a culture that's really not comfortable talking or thinking about death.
Mm.
In 2011, this really cool artist and I'd argue scientist called J. Rim Lee put out an incredible TED talk. If you have the time to watch it, do.
Cool.
But it's all about her mushroom burial suit.
It is
so cool. I'm pretty sure I've spoken.
Is she wearing it?
Yeah, she's wearing it. Have you seen it?
Yeah.
Oh, it's so cool.
So what, she's made a suit which is made of mushrooms that she can be buried in to turn her back into the earth?
Basically, yeah. So it's a suit that's kind of crocheted with a porous fabric, and it's impregnated with mushroom spores that in theory will digest her body. Yeah. And like purify all of the toxins, so that the stuff that she's releasing back into the ground is like
so friendly. Clever,
it's so no cool. Mercury.
New burial preference unlocked.
Yeah,
so make note in phone.
Honestly,
mushroom suit.
It's so cool.
It looks
so
pretty natty as well.
Yeah,
it?
It's mad. So her company's called Koio. She calls it her infinity burial suit, and she over the years has been training mushrooms to digest her.
Oh my god.
So she'll feed the mushrooms like bits of her fingernail cuttings, bits of her hair, like her dead skin. Wow. And she picks the ones that are best at breaking her down. So she's created like a kind of infinity human eating mushroom strain.
I smell a sci-fi film where this sort of breaks out of the lab and starts eating. Like,
I don't know. I mean, I think it's, I just think it's clever. Like, and I like the idea of being sort of given back to the earth in a functionally beneficial way rather than
what happens when the mushroom's finished eating her. It's going to turn to someone else.
Maybe it'll be full.
I mean, quite a few people have already donated their bodies to the company so that they can test this out. And there are other companies that are practicing something called human composting, which is you can use like in tandem with a mushroom soup, but it's basically like you put your body in a compost bin. It's not a bin, it's like a little pod thing, and then what comes out is just soil that you can put on your garden.
Wow. You can't put it on your garden because you are the compost. But your relatives can.
I am the compost.
Death but comes to us all.
This is true. But the
Memento Morel.
Well done,
Jesus Christ.
Just whilst we're talking about like kind of death, spirituality, wavy mushrooms. Have you heard of the theory that Jesus was a mushroom?
Sorry, Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ.
No, this is such a manny statement. Go on. I'm sure you've got a justification for it.
In the 1970s, there was a really well-respected philologist, so someone that studies the history of languages and the structure of languages, and archaeologist called John Marco Allegro. And he published a book called The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross, a study of the nature and the origins of Christianity within the fertility cults and ancient Near East.
Okay, I'm with you.
It's a mad title. Basically, he was one of the first British academics to work on the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were like ancient Jewish manuscripts. And his whole thing was going through like the Old and New Testaments and looking at the meanings of certain words and stuff.
Okay.
And what he got from all of his studies was that Jesus was a mushroom, like a magic mushroom, and the disciples and the people who were writing the New Testament were all just tripping on mushrooms.
Okay, he was like, Jesus became the sort of anthropomorphization of their trips.
Yeah.
Is it kind of like Mary Jane being the slang word for marijuana?
Yeah, kind of. I'm not saying Jesus is a mushroom. I'm just saying that there was a guy in the 70s.
He could have been a mushroom.
He could have been a mushroom. Allegedly.
It doesn't really make the ideas of Christianity any less valid if it's just come from a mushroom or whether it's come from a divine being, I don't think.
It really does explain a bit more about why that painting of the Last Supper is so weird.
Yeah, true. Yeah.
That's it for this week's edition of Lunchbox MV. You can follow our socials for foodie facts and podcast updates. We are on X, Facebook, Instagram and TikTok at Lunchbox MV Pod.
Yes, and you can also get in touch and send us your facts, recipes and questions by emailing us lunchbox@qi.com.
So, Rosie, do you have any favourite mushroom recipes for us today?
Well, in my book, Good Time Cooking, the recipe for this mushroom linguine, which is actually really with tagliatelle, is in there.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah, it's a great recipe. It's super easy and it doesn't have that many ingredients. And I think you'd all really like it.
I ate two bowls worth of those.
Yeah, I was super impressed, Jack. Well done.
We will see you next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Lunchbox Envy was hosted by Jack Chambers, Manu Orio, and me, Rosie McKean. It was mixed by Li Ying Lee, and it was produced by Alex Bell. This has been a quite interesting podcast.